Mexico-y. Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia, solartopia, solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found.
But oh, yeah.
Don't you know we're gonna
try to burn too many things we found. That's the Divine Dar Williams singing with Pete Seeger and David Burns. I'm Harvey Sluggo Wasserman here for another hour with the Solartopia Green Power Wellness Show here at PRN. Thank you to the crew in New York, and thank you to my two great guests. Joel Siegel, you've been with us before. How you doing, buddy?
I am
Joel Siegel. Are you there?
Fantastic. It's great, great to hear your voice.
Right. And Jerry Ashton, you're with us too?
That is correct. Thank you.
All right. So we just got the two of you. It's a three-guy show today, but with a gargantuan topic to talk about, which is healthcare, Medicare for all. We got a full hour, so we can go deep into it. But I do want to start, if you don't mind, Jerry, with Joel talking a bit about the fascist coup that is rolling through at least three of our states, Wisconsin, Michigan, and North Carolina. We have residual Republican majorities, which are gerrymandered majorities. They're not legitimate majorities. The gerrymandered Republican majorities in these three states in the state houses. And we've been watching this catastrophic spectacle in Wisconsin, where the Republican legislature, which is a minority legislature in terms of the popular vote, but has been gerrymandered, is refusing to concede power to the new governor, the new attorney general, and are basically gutting the state government. In Michigan, they're doing similar stuff, stripping the government, the powers of the new governor, who is a Democratic woman, and also refusing to go along with a raise in the pay of the people that was voted for by the public in a referendum. And then in North Carolina, we have similar stuff going on. Joel, you're from North Carolina. Can you tell us a bit about what's going on in that state?
Sure. Well, this has been a problem for many years, right? There was the gutting of the Voting Rights Act, 1965 Voting Rights Act, that tens of thousands marched for, bled, and died for, including Martin Luther King, Medgar Evers. And when that was gutted, what happened was Shelby versus Holder Supreme Court case. Basically, they said that states could come up with their own voting laws, and they didn't have to pre-clear it with the Department of Justice. And that's very important, pre-clearance. So that left states to do their own insidious, you know, work and chicanery to strip millions of people of the right to vote and register. And you know, what resulted are long waiting lines, voter suppression. You've had probably guest on your show, we've talked about voter caging, voter purging. So what happened in North Carolina, in one of the counties, a guy named Dan McCready, who ran for Congress against a former minister, Reverend Harris, they have found thousands of provisional ballots never got to where they were supposed to go, that were never counted. So they're asking for do a possible recount, but they're not certifying the elections. And, you know, it's been going on in Robinson County for years and years and years. It's just now finally coming out, you know, in the public. But it's also what's been happening across the nation, especially in the red states and in the South. And this is being taken very seriously by the New York Times. And also you have not only provisional ballots, but a lot of people went to the voting booth and who, you know, used to go to the voting booth, and they just said, sorry, you can't vote because your name's been taken off the voting rolls. And people protested and said, well, you know, I've been voting here for years. But that's because they were cross-checked. So if your name is Bill Smith and you live in Lumberton, North Carolina, but there's a Bill Smith in New Jersey that can, you know, take you off the voting rolls, well, they'll say, well, you didn't vote the last two elections. Well, what happened if you, you know, you were sick? And it is fascism. And, you know, the First Amendment guarantees the right of freedom of speech and assembly, et cetera. But there's also a thing called the freedom of the right to vote. And that's been stripped away in my state and many other states. And it's a crisis. And hopefully, and I'll close by saying, if you look at what Pelosi has done and the Democratic leadership, you know, to my surprise, Barbara Onwine, Transformative Justice Coalition, of which I'm on her board, as are you, we went to Congress seeking a voting rights caucus, and we got one, and they are leading the way to you know, try to restore voting rights and stop voter suppression as the most important, you know, part of the Democratic Party's agenda.
Well, that's good to hear, Jerry, and I'm Joel and Joel Siegel. And I got to say, you know, I want to get into this discussion, and it's, of course, a discussion that take many, many hours, but we have a little less than one now on health care and Medicare for All and medical debt. But I wanted to start the show. And Jerry Ashton, you're welcome to jump in if you have something you want to add to this. But as my listeners know, and as of course Joel knows, I witnessed the theft of an election with my buddy Bob Petrakis in Ohio, the outright theft of an election in Ohio 2004, where John Kerry was the rightful winner, and the Republican apparatus led by the then Secretary of State, J. Kenneth Blackwell, who was visited on election day by Karl Rove and George W. Bush, absolutely just stole that election outright. And they did it in 100 different ways, which we documented. We have documented now. We're up to, I think, 7 books about this. And we've gotten not a single rise from the Democratic Party until this year. And this year, of course, the Democrats took over 40 House seats. But if you look at the math, for example, in North Carolina, my understanding of North Carolina, which is roughly like most of the states, it's within 55-45 Democrat Republican. The House, the delegation to the U.S. House is, I think, 10-3, Republican to Democrat, because it's so thoroughly gerrymandered. Now, if that state were evenly divided, you would have, say, 7 Democrats and 6 Republicans. So there's 4 House seats that were additional that would have gone to the Democrats. If you look at Ohio, which is completely gerrymandered, it again is roughly 50-50 Democrat-Republican. That congressional delegation is 12-4. So if it were 12 Republicans to 4 Democrats. So if it were, as rightfully so, say 8-8, that's another 4 U.S. House seats. And you go around to Michigan, you go to Wisconsin, you go, of course, to Georgia and Florida, and you look at these gerrymandered states, you're talking about another 10-20 House seats that would have gone to the Democrats. And now we've seen this thing, and as a historian, an American historian, I have to say, I know of no precedent in American history for what is being done in the state of Wisconsin, Michigan, and North Carolina. I have to modify that. Dating back to immediately after the Civil War, where you had Reconstruction, and you had an attempt by the federal government and Ulysses S. Grant to remake the South along Democratic lines with a small D. He was actually Republican. You had the Ku Klux Klan and the other fascist, racist organizations come in and stop the democratic process. Now, nothing so blatant has happened in this country until this year, where you have an outright coup going on in Wisconsin, where the incumbent Republican gerrymandered majority in the legislature is stripping the governor of all powers because he is a Democrat.
And you've had the same thing going on in North Carolina, Joel, where you're from, and similar stuff going on in Michigan. And then, of course, in Georgia, we had the governor's race outright stolen, and there's absolutely no doubt about that. And we have to give a big shout-out now to Stacey Abrams, who has finally, as a Democrat, refused to concede. Now, she has announced publicly that under the certain circumstance of this election that the Ku Klux Klan Secretary of State, who ran his own election, Brian Kemp, will be the governor. But she has not conceded that this was a fair and a democratic election. This is the first time, you know, the Democrat has stood up. Al Gore just rolled over in 2000, and and a lot of this mess is because of his unwillingness to fight. John Kerry rolled over in Ohio 2004, the same thing, a completely stolen election. He said nothing and has still said nothing. And then Hillary Clinton did it again in 2016. And finally, I mean, if you're saying, Joel, that the Pelosi and the Democrats are giving a semblance of standing up, it's about time. You know, and it's an outrage that they haven't. And I want to give a shout out. I know this is going to sound odd. I want to give a shout out, in addition to Stacey Abrams, to two heroes of the democratic process that we need to acknowledge, because they have fought in very specific terms on very specific problems with the democratic process. And again, we're going to get to Medicare here, but we're not going to get anywhere with Medicare or medical debt unless we get a democratic government, small d and big D, I suppose, at this point. The first shout out goes to Stacey Abrams has fought. Her big issue in Georgia was voter suppression. And we know, and she filed a lawsuit, which I will talk about next week on this show with Steve Rosenfeld, with a multi-issue a menu of things that the Republicans did to prevent people from voting. And you, of course, Joel, mentioned a bit of that happening in Wisconsin, in North Carolina. Right. I want to shout out to Jill Stein, who persevered, as Hillary Clinton did not, in the 2016 election. And she filed suit in Pennsylvania over how the votes were counted. And she has just won that suit and is actually forcing now Pennsylvania to use hand-counted and machine-processed paper ballots, where you fill out a paper ballot, it goes in a machine, a ballot image is created, and the paper ballot is preserved. And to date, this is the best technology, we think, for getting a reliable vote count. And Jill Stein, just by her force of will, you know, God bless her, God love her, has forced, finally, a reliable vote count system into the election process in Pennsylvania. And so, and this is a very big deal. It will serve as a model for the rest of the country. It needs to be very, very closely looked at. The other hero I want to mention, and you guys, I hope you're sitting down, is actually Arnold Schwarzenegger. When Schwarzenegger was governor in California, the Democrats controlled the assembly and they completely gerrymandered as in other states, the districts for the state assembly and for the congressional delegation. And being a Republican, Schwarzenegger didn't like this. And they put on the ballot in California a system of with a commission, an independent commission, to draw the districts. And Schwarzenegger actually put in, to my understanding, $2 to $3 million of his personal money to pass this thing. And it did pass. And so California, which is now virtually 100% Democrat anyway, and, you know, there are plenty of articles now about saying the Republican Party in California is extinct. But nonetheless, the districts for the state assembly and the congressional delegation are drawn by an independent commission. And that's the way it needs to be through the country. So we now have three major issues of election theft, which has, you know, rendered us far less than a democracy, which are voter suppression, rigged vote counts, and gerrymandered districts. We have three clear documents now to deal with these problems. And let's hope we can. But, you know, North Carolina is just unbelievable, Joel. I don't know, you know, I'm in California. I couldn't stand it in Ohio anymore. But, you know, I'm sure when you go back to North Carolina, it's really a grit your teeth time. So we will deal with this next week, and I wanted to lay that foundation. Jerry, do you have anything you want to say, Jerry Ashton, about this?
No, I happen to be a sympathetic listener to all that you're talking about. Considering that my role at my nonprofit is EVP and co-founder, and nonprofits are known for having to be, shall we say, apolitical. I just want to be sure that anything I do make a comment on, I want everybody to know that these will be my personal opinions and not that of my charity, RIP Medical Dad.
All right. Well, very good. So I think we've laid out some of the basics here that will hopefully make dealing with this problem of Medicare for all and the need for Medicare for all and that immense medical debt possible. And I will go into this in greater detail next week. But these three states, well, four states really in particular, Wisconsin, Michigan, North Carolina, and Georgia are at the core of what, you know, the fascist coup that we're witnessing here. And it really needs to be laid out. And Joel, as you mentioned, the New York Times is finally taking this seriously. And the left, I got to say that when Bob Fitrakis and I broke our stories from Ohio, we were attacked by the left. The Republicans didn't care. They knew what they had done, and they just didn't care that a couple of lefty journalists were pointing it out. That you know, we got attacked by all the publications I'm not going to mention, and hopefully that day is done. All right, let's move ahead now. Jerry Ashton, you have come to us. You are the nonprofit. Tell us what you do, and tell us, please, what we want to talk about here in terms of medical debt and Medicare for all.
Well, thank you. RIP Medical Debt was started by me and another fellow bill collector. The history of this is that I was involved at one point in time with Occupy Wall Street. And in Occupy Wall Street, they had various working groups. They had working groups for alt banking. They had community outreach. And one in particular was called Strike Debt. And Strike Debt was in the process of creating a nonprofit called the Rolling Jubilee. When the occupiers discovered that there was a bill collector in their midst, they figured, and a sympathetic one at that, because I was always giving people good advice about how to escape the clutches of the bill collector, they decided to talk to me about their idea of creating a charity to abolish medical debt, and would I be interested in helping them. So that's kind of an introduction as to how I became involved in something called going out there and buying unpaid and unpayable personal medical debt and seeing that it was abolished, finished, kaput.
Wow. So how did this work? What did you do exactly?
Well, the principle is, and it's something that occupiers didn't have as a skill set, the principles are, in this world, people can go to hospitals, well-funded people called debt buyers, will go to hospitals. About a third of all American hospitals will participate in this. They'll go to a hospital, and they'll offer to buy their uncollected debt for pennies on the dollar. It is strictly a business process. They're trading their dollars in return for accounts. When they own these accounts, they proceed to chase after them full force for the full amount due. And that is legal, and it's an industry that exists that very few people know about until John Oliver came into the game. And I don't know whether or not you folks have seen the John Oliver piece on uncollected bills that he purchased in order to abolish it on his own, just to show what this industry was up to and his what a disgrace it was to him.
Well, tell us about that. Give us some more detail.
what date was that show on so our listeners can track it down and tell us exactly what he did?
Well, the date would have been about a little over 2 years ago. If you go to YouTube and you put in John Oliver and you put abolish medical debt, it will take you right to his piece. And it'll
right, I'm going to do that minute. Right now while we're talking. John right. Oliver, is it O-L, it's O-L-V-E-R, right? Oliver.
Yes,
okay. O-L-I-V-E-R. Abolish medical debt, debt, right? Yeah. YouTube. Let's look on YouTube here. Okay, so I see June 7th, 2016. Or June 5th, 2016.
Now, we're bouncing around history a little bit, but I'll give you an idea of how that came about. I was involved in Occupy in almost from its beginning in 2011, and we helped them create this Rolling Jubilee. My partner, Craig Antico, and I helped create and be we were the backbone of the purchasing element, the operations for the Rolling Jubilee, and occupiers together raised around $700,000, and we used that money to go out to the debt market, and we abolished over $30 million of the debt.
$700,000? You said with $700,000, you abolished $30 million worth of debt?
That is correct.
How did you do that? How does that work?
Well, going back to the idea of bill purchasers, debt buyers going to hospitals, when they buy a medical bill for $10,000, a $10,000 bill, but they buy it for only a fraction of its stated cost, the stated amount due. So they'll pay maybe 5% or $250, that would be more like $500 of a $10,000 bill. And once they've put that $500 out and they've gotten a $10,000 bill to chase after, that's where all the work goes through. Now, this will happen several times over years, where debt buyers and collectors will sell these debts back and forth. When we walk into the picture, we go to these debt buyers and say, look, at our penny's as good as theirs. We want to buy that debt, and we set about purchasing that debt. The biggest difference is, instead of pursuing it, we abolish it. We forgive it. Now, going back
to John
happens, Oliver.
Uh-huh.
Yeah?
Go ahead. Go. Yeah.
Yeah, so going back to John Oliver, somewhere along the way, he picked up the idea that it might be a good thing to do himself. And so he set about setting up a collection agency over the internet in Mississippi, which he says, by the way, is the best way to visit Mississippi. And he so for $50, he became a debt collector, a debt buyer, and he was approached by the debt collection industry, the debt buyers, who then sold him for $60,000, almost $15 million worth of medical debt.
It was $60,000? You got
that is correct.
Million?
And by the way, he overpaid.
You got $15 million worth of medical debt?
That is correct. 9,000 Texans.
Now, that's astounding. So are you saying that in the private market, where these other where the scumbags work, they go to a hospital, and let's say Joel, because I know Joel's going to tell us about his medical debt. Say Joel ran up a $10,000 bill at a hospital in Mississippi, and now a private company will come in there and buy that debt for pennies on the dollar, and then they'll turn around and try and get the full face amount from Joel? Is that right?
That is correct.
And that's what's going on in this country?
That's been going on for years. Now, what's interesting is that there's a tide changing, and RIP medical debt, and Joel will tell you about a summit that he attended in New York City all about ending medical debt. Just this week, this weekend, the three founders of RIP Medical Debt put out our book called End Medical Debt. And there's over almost 200 pages in there that goes through all of the the travesties of what we call a healthcare system from a financial point of view of how it basically abuses and impoverishes Americans.
So your book is called End Medical Debt. Who has published it?
That is correct.
Who published
it? If you put that in your browser, it'll take you right to Amazon.
End Medical Debt, it's at Amazon. Who are the authors?
Jerry Ashton. That's me. Craig Antico, my longtime friend in the collections industry. And then Robert Goff, who is the former executive director for the NYU Physicians Association, who has the huge background in hospitals and medical facilities and physicians. So the three of us got together to write the book that had to be written. We had to bring to people's attention what's been going on, and the fact is we need to change it, and of course that's where we're going to end up talking about universal health care or some approximation of that. Is that helpful?
So you were actually in the collection business before you did all that.
One of the best.
and you went out and
made,
you made threatening phone calls and you dunned people to pay their debt. And then you sent
let me describe it a little bit differently. I made phone calls to people to work with them on outstanding balances to see whether or not they could pay it. So, yes, indeed, I did that for quite a few years. What separated me from other bill collectors is that, number one, I would refuse to work any account that I felt was in some fashion either extortionate or a bill that was produced and created in some fashion that I didn't support. So I would never test things like payday loan debt, for example. So I worked primarily with my clients to help them recover money that, for whatever reason, people didn't pay them. So I felt, still do in many ways, that I'm the guy with the white hat. I'm helping bring back money to the physician so he can pay his staff and pay his own bills. Now, given that, you and I both know, if you get woke, as the saying goes, you'll realize that it's the profit structure within the system that creates the excesses and the pains. And the United States is the only industrialized nation that does not have universal health care. It's the only country in the United States where 60% of all bankruptcies would be medical debt related. This is a country that will allow credit reports to have marks against them for unpaid medical debt. There are 15 million Americans right now who have a credit mark, and the vast majority of this one credit mark is medical. And a mark on your credit report can reduce your credit score from anywhere from 30 to 70 points. So we're not talking about small pain here. We're talking about huge.
So you were a debt collector, but you had a heart, and you joined the Occupy movement. And then you organized the Occupy movement. You got $700,000 from the occupiers somehow. And you went in and you bought up medical debt to the tune of $15 million. And then you freed X number of people. How many people did you free from medical debt?
we're mixing up a few things here.
All right, go ahead.
Occupy.
Me out.
Occupy, I was the back office for it. I was the functionary. My job was to go out and do good for them. They raised $700,000, and they eliminated $30 million worth of medical debt over that. Now,
how many people did that involve? The $30 million
I can't tell you about our statistics, however, and I'm going to be coming to that in a minute. The statistics with John Oliver is that when he got the idea of doing that, this is after Rolling Jubilee had packed its bags and left town, and Craig Antico and I and Robert Goff, we looked at each other and we said, so much good has been done by this, it's a shame to lose it. And so therefore we started RIP Medical Debt. So you see there was an outgrowth. So fast forward to where John Oliver showed up when he discovered the idea of abolishing medical debt. He never came to us. He didn't know who we were. We were just a small charity struggling. I think our first 2 years we would be lucky if we brought in $30,000, $50,000. But when John Oliver made that grand adventure, that grand leap into purchasing that medical debt, unfortunately, there was one item that wasn't paid attention to, and that's something called HIPAA. HIPAA and permissible use. So this is patient privacy we're talking about. So
right.
Since he was not a charity and a 501c3, and what he was really is a comedian, that's how he terms himself, a comedian
yeah.
who deals with social issues for the laughs, he realized that he put all this money out, and the attorneys at HBO realized that they could not do anything with that debt without getting in trouble with the law. So that's when they started calling around all over New York City trying to find attorneys in the medical field who would be able to give them absolution or at least figure out how to be able to help them complete their show. And that's when we received a phone call, thanks to an attorney who just happened to be quite familiar with us, and they had called her, and they said, well, these are the people to talk to. And that's when we were invited to the HBO headquarters, sat down with them. Every question they had, we had the answers, and we hammered out a deal with them, and we took the problem off their backs. As a legitimate 501c3, they could donate it to us, and we, in turn, could then abolish that debt. Now, that
wow.
debt of 15, what am I talking about? 15 for
million.
John Oliver, that was $60,000. And I'm even confusing myself here. There's so much money involved. About $15 million of the medical debt that he abolished.
With how much?
Yes,
with how much money? Wait. How much money did he put in to do that?
He had to put in $60,000.
$60,000 abolished $15 million worth of debt?
That is correct.
That's a hell of a return, man.
That is a great return. We're one of the hottest nonprofits in town because the ROI is fantastic.
That's unbelievable. That's just phenomenal. Do you know how
it
many
is
people...
Every one of our donors, when our donors come to us and they say, I'd like to help out, I'd like to take some medical debt off of someone's back, every time they give us a dollar, that gets rid of $100. If they give us $1,000, we get rid of $100,000. We had one anonymous couple. Now, we're going to start talking about some big numbers here. We had one anonymous couple come to us and say, we want to make a statement about the horrific conditions of medical debt in America, and we want to get some attention paid to it. And they, how much do you think that would take? And we were puzzled ourselves, and they said, well, you know, $250 million sounds pretty good. $250 million, and they anteed up over $2 million to help hundreds of thousands of Americans. And that purchase and that debt forgiveness just happened last month. It went through Thanksgiving. It's going all the way through Christmas. And as part of that, they also abolished $50 million worth of veterans' unpaid medical debt.
Unbelievable. We're talking with Jerry Ashton and Joel Siegel here about abolishing medical debt. What's the name of your book again?
It's called End Medical Debt.
All right, so if someone's going to be listening to this show who's going to say, God, I got a ton of medical debt, how do I get in touch with these people to get my medical debt extinguished? Now, do you take calls like that?
Well, here's the challenge, and here's what we're facing, and which is what we're gearing up for. We buy debt in bulk. When we go out to the debt buyers, we buy debt millions of dollars at a time. It's a random act of kindness.
From whom? Who do you buy it from?
Debt sellers.
There's an industry of debt sellers. They have gone into
yep.
hospitals. They've bought up debt at pennies on the dollar, and then their business is to turn around and make life miserable for people who owe that debt, and they try and collect it at face value, right?
Well, some people would describe it that way, and I probably would agree with that. Once again,
okay, and, but,
let me, Let me say
so you don't go to the hospital.
We're doing this
you
is because we want to get that debt out of the hands of the collection agency. We want to take it off their desk. So let me explain the criteria. At our website, which is ripmedicaldebt.org, there is a place where people can go and register their names in the hopes that someday we might be able to actually become granular in this. Right now, we can't individually take care of anybody's medical debt. We can't search it out. We can't go to the debt seller. We can't go to the hospital. We can't go to the provider. The system's not set up yet that way. However, we do some very amazing analytics. One of our partners is TransUnion. So we can pretty much slice and dice a lot of information to help us help people either now or in the future. Is this making sense to you?
Yeah. So you want to be able to do on-demand, like Joel here. Joel has medical debt. You want to have a situation where a person like Joel could come to you and say, hey, find my debt, please, and get rid of it.
Well, this is what
is that right?
To happen in his case. This is the life cycle of a debt. Joel gets sick. Joel goes to the hospital. Joel runs up some bills. Joel made as many payments as he could, and then he was underwater. So now Joel is faced with the fact that he's being chased by bill collectors. First, he's chased by the hospital's bill collectors. Then the hospital sends the bill, sends Joel's bill out to collection agencies. Agency number one works it. Agency number two works it. If agency number one has failed, agency number three comes to work because agency two has failed. And then the hospital looks at a year or 2 years later and says, we have worthless debt on our books. And in walks a debt buyer. Well, I'll trade you $1 million for $100 million worth of your bad debt. Now, if you're in the hospital CFO and you're being offered $1 million, real cash, and you've got payroll and you've got bills to pay, you can understand why the industry exists. You got that?
Yeah.
Now,
so
when Joel's bill is purchased, when Joel's bill as part of a huge bag of money is purchased by the debt buyer, he is now in the world of the debt buyer, who then pursues the debt himself because he owns that debt, or he sells that debt to other agencies who then pursue it because they own it. When we buy debt, we own it, and we can do anything we want with it within legal strictures. And what we choose to do is to slit his throat. So if Joel is lucky enough to be in that portfolio, that was just Joel's lucky day.
Wow, amazing. And does your book explain this?
In detail. There are three authors for the book, myself and Craig and Robert Goff. We made an agreement with the publisher. And by the way, this book is all of our own opinions. It's not RIP Medical Debt's book. It's our book, but we're donating all the proceeds of this, profits of this book, to RIP Medical Debt. But when we created it, we made an agreement with the publisher, Judah Fried.
Who is the publisher? Who's the publisher?
What's that?
Who is the publisher?
What's that?
The publisher. Who is the publisher?
Oh, this is Judah Fried of Hoku House in Hawaii.
Uh-huh.
So he said to us, and we said to him, what we want to do is we want to write these chapters separately. We don't want to influence each other because we each have a different skill set. We saw the industry differently. I would be considered, if someone were to be judging me, more left of center. Perhaps one of my other partners would be more right of center, and one would be probably someone who would be considered sane, middle of the road. So what happens is that when someone reads this book, they're going to get three different points of view that somehow or another seem to make sense. People that might disagree internally have agreed to one thing. We want to take the hill. We want to get rid of that debt.
Well, good for you. By God, you're doing God's work here. So, Joel Siegel, what do you got to say about this?
I think Jerry Ashton's incredible. I think this movement's incredible. I just came back from this conference in New York City, and I told Jerry and I told everybody at the conference, I was, you know, he was kind enough to allow me to speak, that this is one of the single most important social movements because it's the Achilles heel of the for-profit corporate system. It's a gigantic mirror on corporate health care that's immoral. It's insane. I owe over 200,000 medical bills. My first bill was when I was a law student. No, I'm sorry. I just got out of law school, and I had surgery for sleep apnea at Stanford, California, and my insurance company, Blue Cross Blue Shield, they call them Blue Cross Blue Steel because they stole most of my money. It said, you must pay $68,000 immediately because they said I had unspecified head and neck surgery. So that was my first major bill, was $68,000 with coverage. And I would say my phone rings every half an hour from a medical debt collector for the last 20 years asking me to repay $200,000-some-odd. I can't do that. So we're this invisible universe of human beings, and medical debt is extremely important because it's taking this issue that a lot of people don't know about, and it's illuminating it not only through the book, but through people like myself who've gone through it. It's going to give us a chance to have a platform, you know, when you can go on HBO, or we're not going to be forgotten anymore. And so I'm supporting this effort because there's millions of people like me. My medical debt, by the way, this month, it will be $1,500 out of pocket. That's just this month. I just paid $12,000 out of pocket for four teeth that need some work. That's with insurance. So what I hope this will lead to is a renewed, re-energized national discussion on universal health care. And as you know, I'm the co-author of a bill called H.R. 676, Expanded and Improved Medicare for All, with 40 very prominent doctors and economists. We had 116 co-sponsors on that bill, first introduced by John Conyers, second by Keith Ellison. And under a Medicare for All single-payer bill, Sanders has introduced the companion bill. There is no copay. There is no deductibles. There's nothing out of pocket. And let's say the way they actually dealt with universal health care in the book is the last chapter, they gave like four or five different ways to reform our healthcare system. So, you know, very objective, I thought, very professional, very well done, Jerry's chapter. And this gives it more soul and more feeling and more power. It's not just so antiseptic. There's millions of people like my mother, who's 88, who unfortunately lives in poverty because she spent over $80,000 during my lifetime on medical bills. And my mother won't be forgotten, and people like me won't be forgotten. So it's incredibly important just to know that medical debt is it's not a problem, by the way. It is a crisis. Doesn't matter whether it's an apartment, whether it's the car that I just bought and the outrageous monthly payment that I have to make. It's because of my medical bills. So I thank God for Jerry and thank God for written medical debt. And you, by the way, the only reason why I got in touch with Jerry was because of you, because you introduced me to Eileen Proctor when I was in Los Angeles, and then Eileen introduced me to Jerry. So you are in the mix, brother. So thank you very much for that contact.
Well, let's hope they find a way to extinguish your medical debt so you can sleep at night. So
it's a bad situation.
What's that? Let's talk now about Medicare for All. It's okay. A horrible night. It's a national disgrace.
Disgrace.
Millions and millions of people all over. I mean, I thankfully have Medicare. And I was lucky enough to not have major medical problems until I was 65. So I had a heart process, a procedure, which is called an ablation. I had a thing where a nerve would set my heart off and it would go up to 200 beats a minute, and it drove me crazy. I hated it. And so and I shopped and shopped and shopped and finally decided to go to the Cleveland Clinic. I went to the Cleveland Clinic for one night. They did not cut me except to put a tube. They put a camera and a soldering iron up my thigh into my heart, into my chest, actually. I don't think they went into my heart. and they burned out. They cauterized a nerve, and by God, it worked. And I have not, thank God. I mean, I can't even begin to tell you that I haven't had an attack. Knocking on wood here since then. So, I have Medicare and I had a backup, Mutual of Omaha. And so everything was covered, but I did get the bill. The bill was sent to me. I was on the table for 3 hours. I was not cut. I had like three nurses and two doctors, and I spent one night in the Cleveland Clinic. It was December 31st, my birthday. I froze and caught a cold, but that's another story. And I got the bill, $60,000, for God's sakes. Which I didn't have to pay, but you know, let me tell you some
good news about the relationship that I built so quickly with Joel, and for whom I'm very grateful. When people buy in medical debt, there are 11 chapters. What I suggest that they do is go directly to chapter 11, because chapter 11 absolutely deals with that one thing called Medicare or Medicaid or universal health care, and we very clearly put out the fact that we wanted to end medical debt. And I put all the different ways, thanks to some help from Joel, I put all the different ways that we could approach this idea of getting medical bills paid, from jury rigging, what we presently have, until we end up with universal health care. So I think the chapter of that title is Universal Healthcare, to be or not to be. And I think you'll learn a lot, and the readers will learn a lot about this sausage making that we call congressional lawmaking that absolutely turns something that could be beautiful into something terrible. But universal healthcare, the argument is there for that. I'll let the reader decide which way they would prefer to vote.
Well, Joel Siegel, you tell us now, how do we get to Medicare for all? Obviously, Medicare works. It's a great system. I go to doctors now, and they take it, and I give them my card. I give them my backup card, and I walk away, and that's it. And that's the way it should be. How do we get there for everybody?
I'll explain it very briefly because I don't want to give a treatise, but basically under H.R. 676, which was John Conyers' version of the bill, and then Keith Ellison's, when you're born, as Jerry, you stated in your excellent book, and I recommend everybody get this book, and Medical Debt's phenomenal book, very well written, easy read, you'll learn a lot. When you're born, you would receive a card, which would say Medicare, and then when you go to your doctor, you go to your pharmacy, you show your card, and then you get your services and you leave without a bill. And then the provider presses a button, and electronically the federal government, through the Medicare system, would reimburse the provider, so there's no paperwork. And then you just expand the Medicare trust fund, right? So instead of paying your premiums to your health insurance company and getting ripped off, their problem is their trust funds are just too small and weak. That's why you have to spend so much money, because they don't pay enough money in their reimbursement to the provider. This would basically 100% reimbursement at a very high level of reimbursement, by the way. So doctors and providers would still benefit. And this is the only way to contain rising healthcare costs, because each year you're going to know exactly how much you're going to pay. It would be basically an increase in the payroll tax, which every economist that's costed off the bill shows would be much less than private insurance. And it would cover anything medically necessary, dental, long-term care. And that's what I just explained to you, is how almost every industrialized nation in the world has been doing this since post-World War II. So this is not anything new. The best system in the world is Taiwan's Medicare single payer. And it turns out that our bill reflects their system, which is, by far the best system in the world. I hope that explains it. There would be some taxes on the very wealthy, and basically would save right around $350 billion a year just in paperwork alone. One estimate is $150 billion a year. The Koch brothers' ridiculous study about it costing $33 trillion is nothing but a lie. That's not how much it's going to cost. And I do think that if there's anyone listening on the show, I think we need to rescore the bill, get some serious economists in a room, and go over that bill and score it and say, here's how much it's going to cost, and here's how we're going to pay for it. That has to be done if it's going to go to the next level in Congress.
Well, what are the chances? I mean, we've got a new House. Are the Democrats serious about pushing Medicare for All?
Yeah, I can answer that question. So I work on climate change, but I do take a detour, but work on single payer. There's three things they're going to work on. One will be a Medicare buy-in, which is explained in the last chapter of and medical debt, where probably between the ages of like 50 and 64, you could do a Medicare buy-in. That's being taken very, very seriously. The other idea is what's called a public option, where the government would pay for some kind of a health care insurance program. Might be like Medicare, could be something like what we had in Congress, which sucked, by the way. But one-third of the Democratic caucus supports Medicare for All. One-third. That's a lot.
That's all?
Members of Congress. One-third.
One-third of the Democrats. So it's opposed, of course, by all the Republicans.
Now, if it's going to get a hearing through the House Energy Committee, right, there would have to be major pressure from constituents. That's the only way it's going to go anywhere. It's constituent pressure. That's how Congress works. It's not just the donors that they listen to. It's the constituents who vote them in or out of office. If there is a movement, a re-energized Medicare for All single-payer movement, it does have an actual chance of going to committee and being passed. Without that movement, it's not going to happen. But number two, unless they score the bill, right, and unless they really can explain to the American people, here's how 676 or a Medicare for All program is going to cost, here's how it's going to be administered, here's how we're going to pay for it, it'd be very hard to build that movement, because the first question that someone will ask, and I'm going to end, is how are you going to pay for it and how much will it cost? If you can't answer that question both in Congress, you can't defend the bill, or to your neighbor, it's not going to go anywhere. I think it can happen. It has to happen. This system is insane. I'm just speaking on behalf of Joel Siegel, right? Patient activist. You cannot be the richest country in the world, Harvey, and then be the poorest country in the world at the same time. If we have a defense budget like we have, and all the money, $16 trillion gross domestic product, we'd have the Rolls Royce. We'd have the best universal system available if we were serious, But it's going to take a unified movement to do that.
Jerry,
I'd like to address that from the point of view of what we're doing as a charity. We realize that abolished $250 million for the medical debt just recently, and we're going to have $500 million by the end of this year. We know that we're sweeping up after the parade. We know that it's the people at the front of the parade that are causing all the work that we're doing. So we know, however, if we get enough attention being paid to us, and a lot is happening. In fact, there was a major New York Times article today about two ladies in Upper New York State who used us to abolish, I think it was $1.2 million of the debt in their area. And that gets local press, and people say, medical debt, what's that? Or I didn't realize it was that horrible. So we're making people aware of the problem in a very unique way. Even though we're quietly sleeping up after the parade, we're not so quiet when we talk to people like you, and we're meeting with people on the Hill that for appointments that are being set up. So that's my 2 cents for this part.
All right. So your book, what's going to happen is the music is going to come on and we're going to be done. So your book is tell us your book and how to get a hold of it, Jerry Ashton.
It's In Medical Debt. If you go to Amazon and type in End Medical Debt, it'll pop right up.
Okay. And I'm looking here online. There's a guy named Richard Neal, a Democrat in Massachusetts, and Jerry and Joel, I'm sure you're familiar with him. He's going to be the chair of the House Ways and Means Committee. He's a Democrat, probably tells himself he's a big liberal, but he's saying that he's going to try and kill Medicare for All. Joel, what are we going to do about it?
If he wants to kill it, then we need people to save it. And the only way to save it is I think there needs to be a national conference on Medicare for all, and there has to be money raised. There's still not an office, by the way, in Washington, D.C. for universal health care. It doesn't exist. And we're going to have to hire organizers, teach the American people about how this will work through PowerPoint presentations, and there has to be constituent pressure, but that cannot be done unless there is a fully funded Medicare for all single-payer movement, and that's, I think, that's the next step. Otherwise, it will be killed. But I'm
all right.
I'm an optimist, man. I think we can pass.
How do people get a hold of you, Joel Siegel? How do people get a hold of you to join in this movement?
You call me on my cell phone at 571-344-1518, and I will plug you into this movement. There are a few different versions of the single payer bill that are going to be introduced, and hopefully we'll be one big family, and we'll be able to push it through one day. It's going to happen. It's just a matter. It's not whether it will. It's about when it's going to happen. It has to happen. We're going to bankrupt this nation. We will bankrupt this nation if we don't do this.
And Jerry Ashton, if people want to donate and help buy medical debt, how do they do?
It's ripmedicaldebt.org. When you land on our website, you'll learn more about us. You'll educate yourself. You'll see some of the other campaigns we've done. So, and there is a donate button at that site as well.
All right, I'm going to send you $108. And you can tell me how much medical debt. You guys, thank you so much. Great show. Thank you both. See you next week in Silvertopia. And thank you to the crew in New York. Much appreciated.
Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden. Don't you know we're gone?